From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Tomorrow, America celebrates her 226th birthday in the traditional way, with fireworks displays and town picnics across the country. But there'll be a few new wrinkles. Most people will attend these events under the watchful eye of security cameras after passing through metal detectors, and the skies above them will be patrolled and patrolled. It's also probable that more people will be flying the flag on the front lawn than in years past, proof that public displays of patriotism continue on the first Independence Day since September 11th. But, On Point listeners, what does it mean to be patriotic today? How does one voice dissent under the banner of patriotic fervor? On the first Independence Day since the attacks of September 11th, does being an American mean something different for you? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me in the studio is Thomas Cushman, professor of sociology at Wellesley College, who will be teaching a course on patriotism in the fall. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
And also in the studio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, who just told me that 20 years ago he was the author of Patriotism for Liberals. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening.
And we have other guests coming later in the hour, but let me quickly turn to Thomas Cushman and ask him, the patriotism upsurge since September 11th, we can understand why, is it markedly different than the patriotism that America might have expressed 30 years ago or 50 years ago?
Well, I'm not sure patriotism differs all that much across time and across space, but I do think that what we're seeing is an intensification of something that's rather powerful already in American culture, and that this is an intensification that, unlike we've ever seen before, even in times of other kinds of wars, it seems to me, because of the nature of the attack and that kind of thing. I think that we have a situation where many Americans are being patriotic for the first time, especially people of the baby boom generation who aren't used to being patriotic.
Well, when you say patriotic, do you mean effusively patriotic, or do you mean that they actually are experiencing, I suppose we should have started with a working definition for this conversation of what patriotism actually is. Because when you say that the baby boom generation hasn't been patriotic as a charter card-bearing member, I say, I've always been patriotic. I just happened to go into the streets in 1968, and for good reason.
Well, I think maybe it would be a good idea to make some kind of idea about what patriotism is. I think part of the problem with discussing patriotism is that people have so many conceptions about it and judgments about it that they don't stop to think about what it is analytically.
What is it analytically?
Well, I generally start these conversations by discussing George Orwell's distinction between nationalism and patriotism. And George Orwell wrote a very famous essay called Notes on Nationalism, which I have here, in which he tries to make a distinction between nationalism and patriotism because he's aware that most people confuse those two things, that when they think patriotism, they think nationalism. And he says very explicitly, he says, nationalism is not to be confused with patriotism. Both words are normally used in so vague a way that any definition is liable to be challenged, but one must draw a distinction between them since two different and even opposing ideas are involved. And here's a definition. By patriotism, I mean devotion to a particular place and a particular way of life, which one believes to be the best in the world but has no wish to force on other people. I agree with about 80% of that. Patriotism doesn't have to even have the idea – it has to have the idea of devotion to a particular place and a way of life, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be – think it's the best in the world. It's simply a love of place, mm-hmm. a love of country, a love of one's locale, mm-hmm. an attachment to that, which we all feel. Mm-hmm. Some feel it for a community, some feel it for a city or a town, some feel it for a nation. But in this case, I think in this case, patriotism is more of a defensive phenomenon than an offensive one. This is Orwell's idea, in fact. He says patriotism is of its nature defensive. Nationalism, on the other hand, is aggressive and expresses a desire for power. And I think that what we're seeing in the United States now is a defensive reaction, a ritual of solidarity, which has awakened latent emotions and feelings in people, and very understandably so. And that tomorrow, being July 4th, you're going to see a kind of hyper-ritual, a hyper-celebration of those values and ideas and attachments that Americans have had periodically and have ebbed and flowed over the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, I'd like to bring into the conversation now Colonel David Hack Hackworth, whose new book, Steal My Soldiers' Hearts, has just been published. And for 52 years, Colonel Hackworth was a part of the military. And in fact, Hack, am I right? You actually enlisted and fought in World War II as a teenager?
I enlisted at age 14. And in 1945, at the end of World War II. And my background is my family came here in 1622 and settled in Virginia and kind of went from Virginia to California and settling this land. And so it was a great value in my family of to serve country, to defend country. And it's something that I always took for granted. So as a little boy, the Pledge of Allegiance was something that was happened at school. The national anthem still brings chills to my spine. And then the values that I got from my family about doing the right thing, standing tall for my country, caused me to want to serve my country.
But you were only 14, so you must have told a little bit of a fib to get past the recruiters.
Well, they didn't ask a lot of questions in those days. If you could pick up a 9.5 M1 rifle, that was good enough. But yes, there was a major fib. It was like, I'm old enough, because I was anxious to go to war. I had seen the threat of war to my little town in California with barbed wire on the beach and searchlights scanning the sky and anti-aircraft guns actually firing at every Japanese cloud that went by because the gunners were all battle-rattled. And so I kind of felt the war perhaps a lot more than the average American, maybe from middle America, because we had blackouts and air raid wardens knocking on your door and telling you button up those curtains and
Let me ask you, you went on from your teenage service in World War II and you stayed in the military, fought in Korea and in Vietnam, which has been what you've written about most. Do you think that the nature of patriotism in America has changed over that period of time?
Oh, very much so. And I think a defining moment was the Vietnam War, because it was a challenge to the government, and it caused everyone to say, you know, are we being unpatriotic to challenge this war, which turned out to be, and people like me made the 180 turn that it was a bad war. We shouldn't have been there. But so many people, especially in the interviewing of the kids for the book, and I knew them as 19-year-olds and are now mid-50s, but I still think of those brave, noble kids that fought a very a war that was not very noble. And so many of them told me they didn't want to go. They knew it was a bad war, but their father said, "You'll go." I went, and it's a patriotic duty. So they had that conflict between serving country and knowing what is right and what is wrong, but the pressure of the family saying, "You'll go," and they went.
Jack Beattie, you wrote about patriotism for liberals 20 years ago. Did that come out of the sense that, you know, those of us who were in the street in 1968 might have been seen by others as being unpatriotic?
Yes, and I think that Colonel Hackworth sort of models it. I mean, he's a patriot, and he's also been a critic, not alone of the Vietnam War, but of the current Pentagon. And Colonel, what do you feel when you hear an attorney general say that criticism of the administration is anti-American? It intimates that. What do you hear when the vice president makes similar comments?
Well, I try not to take a political position on anything, but and I haven't heard this fellow say this, but I've been one to always speak what I thought was the truth, and if they in fact said that, I would say that they're wrong. It's part of our whole democratic being is to sound off and express how we feel, and we don't all march to the same drummer.
Tom Cushman.
I'd like to add to that actually that kind of insinuation that criticizing the government is anti-patriotic really misunderstands what patriotism is. patriotism is not a love of a government or an administration or a president. It can be a love of a president. It sometimes expresses itself that way. But it's a love of a place. It's a love of an idea. It's a love of a culture. It's a love of a set of ideas. It's a love of a way of life, a love of culture. And, in fact, some of the greatest patriots in American history have been ardent critics of the government and of the American government, of the administrations of various presidents. So I think it's a real really misleading to misuse the idea of patriotism. And I don't think Americans – well, it's hard to say whether Americans feel like that's being unpatriotic. But
you know what's interesting to me is I went online today and searched the words patriotic quotes so I could sound erudite and learned during this discussion. And it was really astonishing to me, not how many websites there were offering patriotic quotes, because you'd expect that, but how many quotes that were considered patriotic were militaristic. Mm. That you know, gung-ho statements about fighting for land, without even using the word patriotism, were considered to be patriotic quotes. Now, Hack, you're the resident military man on this panel. Do you feel that that's a good idea or a bad idea in terms of defining a patriotism for today?
I think it's a bad idea. My experience, and just for understanding where I'm coming from, I spent 7 years in an infantry platoon or an infantry company or an infantry battalion in combat. That's a long, long time. I can't recall anyone ever fighting for the flag, mom's apple pie, or all of these things that people are beating the drums about. What we fought for was each other, bringing that guy back, and guys risking their life for their brothers. But all of this big patriotic, give me liberty or give me death, didn't move anybody on the battlefield. What it was about was trying to make it through the night and make sure that your brothers, who you became wedded to in probably a more deeply emotional way than you did your real brothers.
Tom Cushman, has patriotism always had an umbilical connection to military adventure?
Well, again, it depends on whether you consider patriotism to be the same thing as nationalism. Certainly, the fighting for the fatherland and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I think the German insinuation of the Vaterland and the nation makes people suspect of any time people are praising their own nation, saying it's better than other people's. I don't necessarily
but
think.
Doesn't it get forward to me? Nations in their histories frequently have to fight to assert their nationhood. We don't live side by side and never have comfortably and at peace. And so patriotism does get tied into the military, doesn't it? Because, you know, we need these sentiments in times when our nation is challenged.
Yes. Well, I just want to say I think the colonel's, from what I know about it, I certainly don't have his experience, but I do think that what he says about military situations is correct, that very often it's about the platoon, about the person, and that may not have to be about any grand ideals. And this was actually very clear in the Nazi case, that there was interviews with the Nazi soldiers after World War II, and they asked them why they fight, and they weren't fighting for the Fuhrer, they weren't fighting for the Nazi party, they were fighting for their comrades. And, you know, yeah, that's a different kind of a thing.
And also their unit. There is a development that comes out, that an esprit towards the regiment, the 27th Wolfhound. It's something that's driven in you, and you become very proud of that institution. And I can recall in the Korean War that the boys would wear their regimental crest, which were shiny little brass Wolfhound insignia, in battle, because mm-hmm. they were so proud of it. Mm-hmm. But I never saw anybody waving an American flag other than the Marines, which I understand was a photo opportunity on Iwo Jima.
Well, you know, Michael, that point you were making, pick up on what you were saying, the colonel was saying, that about the military quality of quotations, discourse about patriotism, I think a lot of that has to do not so much with vindications of power as of sacrifice. Lincoln had this when he talked to the South just before the war. He said, the mystic cords of memory that go back to Bunker Hill bind us, don't they?
We're coming up to the break. That's what the music means. We're talking, On Point listeners, about patriotism. Seems appropriate. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour, listeners, about patriotism. It's a word that's become a litmus test, battleground. It shouldn't be. We're going to try and find a proper definition of what patriotism should be for Americans, hopefully during the course of this conversation. 800-423-8255. We need your help to talk about this definition. 800-423-TALK. Join in the conversation. We're joined now by Carolyn Marvin, who's been listening into the first part of the show from Philadelphia. She's a professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good.
So it's been the boys talking now. I'm just wondering, now, it doesn't have to necessarily be a gender differences on what patriotism means, but what do you think about patriotism?
Well, I think I would add this definition. I think that patriotism is public witness to the idea that the nation is a community of moral obligation. And I think that's a definition that can cover dissent. It's a definition that can cover military service. It's a definition that can cover all kinds of community activities. But the idea is that we owe each other something.
How do we display this?
Oh, I think the flag is a very good way to display it. You know, the flag has the convenient characteristic of not being language. And so there's a way in which the fact that we're all different and the fact that we often do disagree about things is covered over, but in a very useful way, by this flag that has no specific language, but that we all can wave or share or burn or in some way demonstrate our connection to.
It's interesting. Henry Ward Beecher wrote, "A thoughtful mind, when it sees a nation's flag, sees not the flag only, but whatever may be its symbols, its insignia. He reads chiefly in the flag the principles, the truths, the history which belongs to the nation which sets it forth."
Well, that's a lot to put on the flag, isn't it? And that's why it becomes such an important symbol to us, because we do invest all those things in it. And we have so many ways of depicting the flag, both gesturing with it. I mean, we have all kinds of different rituals in which we have the flag. It appears in all kinds of images. We cut it up and make bunting out of it. We make clothes out of it. We make advertising out of it. It's a very, very useful, living symbol.
Let me ask you, Tom. Flags down the centuries. I mean, you studied patriotic expression, you know, going back a long way. When did the flag take on this?
That's a good question. I think it's always been a symbol of a certain kind of solidarity. I think that's the crucial word here. All communities need symbols of solidarity, and I think obviously the American Revolution was a time when that was born as the symbol of the American Revolution. I'm not entirely sure that patriotism, though, resides completely in symbols. I think that it expresses certain common ideas, but the problem with that is that the flag means so many different things to so many different people. I think the real crucial element of patriotism now is the ways in which people are coming together to talk about the meaning of America after 9/11, to talk about what America means to them, and that patriotism isn't any one thing. Patriotism is everyone can define what America is for themselves, and I think people are doing that more and more across boundaries, across ethnic boundaries, and that kind of thing. So it's not just symbolic.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dale is on the line.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I disagree with a lot of what you're saying. I think that the 60s generation in particular, what you're coining as patriotism was in fact cynicism, bordering really a belief. It, to me, it would be traitorism. I guess that was a correct term, but I think liberalism is born a different way we feel about our country after 9/11. How I've heard a lot of those from the liberal left complain about Bush, President Bush, and what he did, and mentioning this is his war.
Dale, let me ask you, do you think that within our country that there's room for that width of political expression and for people to express concern about the way the country's business is conducted?
Sure, I think there is. I don't regard that as patriotism, though. I think that's cynicism. Furthermore, I think burning the flag is not patriotic. I don't think it's a matter of free speech. There has to be a line that's drawn somewhere. And
Carolyn Marvin.
Oh, I don't see why patriotism is inconsistent with burning the flag. I know that's not a popular position, but you know, I think that if that's exactly what happened during the Vietnam War, is that people used the flag, they turned it upside down, they wrote on it, and what they were saying was it was an important, it was a symbol that could actually convey their dissent and unhappiness, and you know, that's opposition to what's going on, but it's within the framework of that medium that we all understand.
Colonel Hackworth, when you would take leave and come back from Vietnam and saw the flag used and abused as a symbol, what did that make you feel at the time?
I didn't see that. What I saw upon return between tours in Vietnam, and remember I was there 5 years, was that the soldier was attacked. So often, it happened to myself in the Los Angeles air terminal, was I was assaulted because I was in uniform coming back from Vietnam, and I was looked upon as a murderer when, hey, listen, my country sent me. And I think that's one of the grievances that so many Vietnam veterans have.
So would you understand Dale's point of view?
Yes, but the point that I'm trying to make is that so many people were so embittered over the Vietnam War that what they did was they attacked the soldier, who in most cases was a Vietnam veteran that was a draftee that didn't want to go there in the first place, but went when his nation called. And he was the guy that got the blame instead of the McNamara's or the Johnsons or the Nixons. And what I've noticed since 9/11, which I think is interesting among young people in the nation, is so many of them have come to me, and I'm talking about 35 on down, that they've taken it all for granted. They didn't realize there was a price of admission, that somebody had paid it at there where you are at Bunker Hill or at Gettysburg or somewhere along the line, Normandy Beach, had paid the price for our freedom. And so many people in that age group have come and said, 9/11 has really been a big awakening for me, and I understand about the price of admission.
Yeah. You know, I just want to pick up on something you said, and Carolyn, I think it was one of the great, not just tactical blunders, but moral failures of the anti-war movement to burn the flag. I think that was an offensive and counterproductive thing to do. And I think in general, the anti-war movement, which was an amazing movement of conscience, failed to become and gel as a permanent part of American life, where we really could talk about what American foreign policy should be, what the American national identity would be. All of that miscarried because of the extreme tactics of people who were against the war. And they weren't just against the war. I remember at demonstrations and feeling ashamed seeing Viet Cong, North Vietnamese flags. That was appalling. These people, I think, they had a right to do it, but I really think that wasn't patriotic at all.
Well, can I say here that I want to say about Dale that, you know, I think cynicism is too easy a way out. I think responsible citizens are always looking at their government and thinking about how it ought to be better and having ideals for it and wanting them. But I would say about the anti-war movement that I think there were irresponsible people on both sides of the Vietnam War conflict. But I think the flag really, really does belong to all the citizens, and I think the flag is something that the citizens get to decide how they want to use, what they want to express with it. And so I think that burning the flag is a very dramatic act, and I think that it has meaning and significance, and I don't think it's automatically irresponsible. I think the anti-war movement...
Carolyn, when you see the flag being burned in Tehran or in the streets of other capitals of the Arab world, what does it make you feel?
Well, I know they're mad at us, you know. I think I feel very differently when American citizens burn it. I'm much more concerned about the kinds of divisions that are going on when American citizens burn it. I think, you know, in the Vietnam War, and I think Colonel Hackworth has alluded to this, there were plenty of, I'm not sure it was the flag burning that was causing the problem nearly so much as it was very bad policies on the part of the government to which the anti-war movement, in fact, responded.
Well, I just have an anecdote. A friend of mine who has an 85-year-old father who fought in the South Pacific tells me that several days in a week he was driving by a ravine, and he could see that there was a flag down there, and he went by it one day. It was a flag that had somehow blown off. And at 85, he climbed down that ravine and through the swamp and picked up the flag and came home stoking with mud and everything else because he just couldn't see that flag down in the swamp. That's patriotism.
That's a great thing, you know, but that doesn't mean that that's the only thing you can do with the flag.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Joe is on the line.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
By the way. Something you just mentioned sparked a thought in my mind when one of the individuals asked, what do you think when you see people in Tehran? And I'm sure a few people in Tehran had the same thought. Gee, we can burn the American flag here, but we sure don't dare burn our flag because they'll be executed.
And I think, too, that so much of the burning of our flag and in some of these wild western places around the world, that's all propaganda gimmick.
Very right.
I could recall being in Haiti as a reporter and seeing this big truck arrive just before Carter and Colin Powell came down to do it, try to cinch up a peace deal. And everyone was issued a poster and American flags, in which the posters were neatly made, you know, anti-American, and they all had their flags. And they got off, and whistles were blowing, guys behind them with microphones telling them what to do, and on order, they all burned their flag.
Joe, let's get to your point, though.
Yes, very quickly, I wanted to mention, and I'm sure this will be a digression, and if you don't want to pick up on it, that's fine. Locally in our paper here, there was a letter a few weeks ago that said filthy atheists would never even, how dare they even say they would, had they have patriotism, they wouldn't even serve in the military. Well, I was an atheist before I went into the military. I was an atheist throughout the military, and I'm still an atheist, but I still... As the colonel said, and it's an honor to be on the same phone conversation with him, I still become misty-eyed each time the national anthem's played. I still get choked up. I was not in Vietnam. I go to the Vietnam Memorial and I weep. Obviously, I don't pray. But the fellow who called earlier, Dale, unless he's a veteran, doesn't realize, and like the black people in the black men in World War II, and like the atheist I was, you're fighting for the liberty for everyone, even though you know you're going to come back and you're not going to be treated well. Look at the people who were in, and briefly, the blacks who served in the segregated services who came back and were still held back. I didn't go thinking, well, I'm going to make it better for atheists. I went for the idea for my country, for patriotism, because even though I'm an ultra minority, I still feel this is the best place to be for all of our thoughts.
Joe,
I'll let it go at that.
Joe,
but
thank you very much for that comment. That was wonderful. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ali is on the line.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Just wanted to bring up a point that there is an appeal to for America from everyone across the world. And I don't know if people such as myself, who's not even a citizen, but loves this place and would do anything to protect this place,
Ali, let me just ask you some background. When did you get to this country?
I came here, actually, a while back. I came here in 86, and I went to high school and college. And actually, I saw those flag burnings in Tehran, and everyone knew that this is just propaganda. This is just, let's pick on someone, let's pick on America. That was all propaganda, and no one in their right mind grabbed a flag and burnt it. So,
I interrupted you, and I'm sorry, I just wanted to know where you were from. Your question was, what place is there?
I'm from Iran, actually.
Right, but what place there is for people who aren't citizens but who live in the country?
Oh, yes. The definition that you're giving about patriotism, I think it should include everyone. The fact that there is a huge number of people in every part of the world that would love to come here, not just for the economy, not just for, simple things that you might think, oh, they get a job, or they're going to leech off the social system, but for the fact that this is the best place in the world. There's no question about it. The fact that we can talk just an hour ago, talking about, oh, President Bush is so dumb, or somebody come and say, defend the president. This makes the place the most popular place in the world, I think.
Tom Cushman.
I would mention that some of the greatest patriots have been foreigners. Thinking of Lafayette during the American Revolutionary War. He was a great lover of America, brought the ideals back to France. Napoleon was in some ways a foreigner in France. He was a great French patriot. Stalin was a patriot in Russia. He was a Georgian. So I think that it's really interesting to me how certain kinds of people who are foreign to a culture can come to love the culture and sometimes even stand as a model of the culture, as in many other cases through history.
Ali, I want to thank you for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ruth is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Ruth.
Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I'm pretty young, so I've never done something like this before, but I lived for a while in Guatemala, and I had, as a young American, I've felt very ashamed of being part of this country upon coming face-to-face with some of the atrocities that we've committed in Latin America and having to face that guilt as a citizen. And one of the ways that I've been thinking recently about looking to heal our nation a little bit and heal some of our wounds is in terms of youth work, because I think America is young itself. You know, we're a bit of a teenager, and we throw our weight around pretty arrogantly throughout the world and pretty violently. And looking as a youth worker at how we would deal with a kid who's in a gang trying to do the kinds of things in his town that we try and do in the world. How do you deal with that? How do you be supportive of that kid without putting them on defensive? How do we be supportive of our country without putting our government on the defensive? You know what I mean?
Carolyn Marvin, what do you say to Ruth?
Well, I guess I think one of the things that we need most in the country that we don't have is a way for young people to participate in a really active way in this obligation that they have to their country. And I think kids who are in gangs are one of the motives there is a sense of belonging and a sense of contributing to a community and supporting other people. And I think it would be a great thing if we could figure out a way to involve young people. I myself would be in favor of a compulsory draft for everyone. I'd like to see not only poor kids in the draft, but the rich ones.
Yeah. Ruth, I want to thank you for calling, and you said you were young. Call again. You know, this is part of the joy of being American, and you can call in anytime. You don't always get on the air because there's a huge queue of calls, but keep listening and please keep calling. Carolyn Marvin, thank you for joining us. Carolyn Marvin is professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania. The rest of my guests can stand at ease while we take the go through the break. It's almost the 4th of July. We're talking about patriotism. And it still seems from some of the calls that the word is still being argued over as if the culture wars have not had a truce yet. Let's get beyond the culture wars. Let's talk about patriotism with enthusiasm. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking about patriotism and what it means. Post 9/11 was the original idea, but we're still talking about patriotism and what it means post 1968. Still stuck in the cultural wars. Anyway, Jack Beatty, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You have something to say.
I just want to talk about the distinction that Tom was making, Orwell's distinction that patriotism is about attachment to a place. Generically, I think that's so, and I certainly see that as so of British patriotism. But I think there's a different flavor in American patriotism, and I think Ali was getting at it. And that is that we're not based on blood and soil. That's not the American. For one thing, we don't have a nationality. What we are based on is an idea. Documents, a declaration, a constitution that say all men are created equal and that say that these rights apply to all. So we stand for universal ideals of freedom, of liberty, of openness, of being able to criticize the government. And it seems to me that's what people around the world, when they feel about America, they're not thinking about America as a place. It's America as an idea.
Tom Cushman. Was that you, Colonel Hackworth?
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I think that
our ability to criticize government or whatever comes from this innate freedom that we have, that we know that we can sound off and there's not going to be a knock on the door. For example, after 5 years in Vietnam as a serving soldier and realizing for 5 years and criticizing that war just again and again and again and telling the chief of staff of the Army in 1966 that we were losing it, the secretary of the Army in 1967 and 68 that we were losing it face to face, and still not being lined up against a wall and shot as it would have occurred in the Nazi Army, and then finally in 1971 sounding off on a program called Issues and Answers and telling the whole nation that we should get out, we're being lied to, the war was not winnable. And that was motivated because I saw so many young people put in body bags and no one really cared. And I got away with this. And so that would only happen in this great free country of ours.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Craig is calling from Rice Lake, Wisconsin.
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, when I think of the United States, I think of the Bill of Rights, and I think of the Constitution. I think that is the premise of our whole country. That's what's made us great. What I think's happening now, and I'm not talking just the flag, I think what we're subverting now is we've got our power structure and we're being bought by interests that don't necessarily think freedom, the Bill of Rights, is the preeminent foundation of our country.
Craig, let me ask you, what does a patriot do about that?
A patriot, and I'm going to, if I can back up, I think the guys that fought in Vietnam were great, whether it's right or wrong. They were believing in what was right as they saw it. World War II, World War I, that's great. Bosnia, that's...
Craig, is there a question or is this a comment?
The comment is, it gets back to what we're doing with Bush. He comes up, and in my opinion, one of the Bill of Rights is right to private property. We are supporting an invasion in the West Bank.
Okay.
We are supposedly the greatest country in the world. And every time an Israeli says something, Bush runs back to the White House.
Okay, great. Craig, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We're coming to the end of the segment, and I've got three guests, and I want to hear a final word from each of them about patriotism today, this July 4th about to happen. What's changed for you and your feelings for this country, Jack Beatty, over your lifetime?
Oh, well, I guess... you know, I remember reading something George Kennan said. He certainly served this country as a diplomat for many years, perhaps the most distinguished diplomat of the 20th century. And he said that increasingly as he grew older, he was serving America and loving the country despite itself, despite what it did. It was a patriotism despite. And in my adult lifetime, I have felt that more and more. I'm patriotic despite what the country so often does, and as the country is so often represented.
Tom Cushman.
Well, I think for people of my age, my generation, it's been hard to be patriotic. I was too young to really participate in the Vietnam era, but I witnessed it as a 10-year-old. And but for my generation, we grew up in the me generation, the kind of culture of narcissism where everything revolved around the self and the individual. So it was hard for us to feel patriotic, and for those of us who had were involved in intellectual life, it was even harder because there's such a stigma to being patriotic in that kind of culture. So I think for me and for people in my generation, there's the challenge now of how to express an affection for the country without falling into the trap of blind allegiance how to express it individually, how to express it in a way which suits you and doesn't seem like a groupthink. And that's what we're struggling with now. I think all Americans are struggling with that, how to be patriotic in their own special way without being subservient, because Americans don't really like to be that way.
Colonel Hackworth, we're coming very rapidly to the end of this segment, so I'm going to have to ask you quickly, how has your feelings for this country changed over your 50-plus years of military service?
Well, I think basically since 1776, there's been no gene change in the American youth. And I've just visited West Point, the Air Force Academy, the Coast Guard Academy, the Military Academy, and probably a dozen military installations. In the course of these, talked to thousands of young men and women. And I got to tell you, I'm really inspired.
Thank you, Colonel Hackworth. Thank you also, Tom Cushman, and thanks, as always, to Jack Beattie, our senior news analyst. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. John Locke said it, in the beginning, all the world was America. And in a moment, reflections on America's birthday. This is On Point. As America blows out the 226 candles on her birthday cake tomorrow, there will be the usual wishes for a bright future. Writer James Carroll has been thinking about the meaning of July 4th and finds that celebrating America's beginning also means confronting the fact that someday this great republic, too, shall end. Here is James Carroll reading his column entitled Intimations of America's Mortality.
We celebrate beginnings, whether of persons or nations, as a way of honoring our place in time. The joyful rituals of July 4th, observed nowhere more happily than in Boston, remind us of the day on which our country came into being. This week we feast on summer food, listen to patriotic music, send up flares, and perhaps choke for a moment on the high emotion of love for this country. But to acknowledge that the United States of America has a beginning and is thus bound by the rules of time is implicitly to recall that this nation will equally have an end. What the 4th of July celebrates at bottom is American mortality. Like every birthday celebration, it defies the human temptation to imagine oneself as living forever. There is a time past when we did not exist. And there is a time future when, again, we will not exist. To remember the one is to anticipate the other. And everything America accomplishes and signifies must be measured finally against this radical transience within which it all occurs. What could be more obvious, you ask? And yet the truth of our national mortality eludes us. The ultimate demise of the United States is deeply unsettling, even if only in prospect. This is more true of our nation, perhaps, than of others, precisely because we define ourselves in terms more of the future than the past. The greatness of Britain or Greece is tied to what it was, which is why immigrants to those countries, not sharing the past, take on national identity with difficulty. American greatness is always tied to what the nation is becoming, which is why immigrants here feel readily commissioned to create that greatness. The American future belongs equally to everyone. But what if the future is finite, which is another way of asking about death? At Gettysburg, Lincoln suggested that our hallowed dead will not have died in vain. Only if, in the future, the great task remaining before us is accomplished. Lincoln thus gave voice to a basic American assumption that present experience is justified only by future outcomes. But if ever the Union perishes from the earth, will all those who died for it in the past have died in vain? In a world that remains bound by the rules of time and mortality, no matter how cloaked by patriotic fervor, Is the characteristically American idea of boundlessness inevitably self-defeating? If America has defined the future as its only absolute, what happens when the future, too, is revealed as relative? This forward-looking ideology has been an engine of industry and social justice, but is it nevertheless built on a contradiction? And why shouldn't Americans have looked for ways to avoid the bite of such questions? Enter God. Here is the context in which to understand the use to which we have put our civic religion. When we claim to be a nation under God, and it was Lincoln who first used that phrase at Gettysburg, or when we blithely pray, God bless America, assuming that God's blessing for this country is unique, we are appropriating for ourselves divine attributes of infinity and immortality that, in fact, have no place on earth. And notice, we do this, 1863, 1954, 2001, when our future seems most at risk, the American variation on faith in foxholes. It should be no surprise that in the current period of acute national anxiety, we have resumed our emphatic dependency on God talk, and no surprise that a court that presumed to question it should have been so efficiently slapped down last week. We Americans feel vulnerable enough without surrendering the sense of transcendent protection that derives from public expression of our felt connection to God. Thus, much more is at stake in our public appeals to God than constitutional questions about church and state. Every nation has a way of invoking the divinity, and every army goes into battle under the patronage of some god or other. Nothing new in that. But the American appeal is different because of the function God serves as a solution to the American problem. We yearn to think of ourselves as the indispensable nation, hoping to postpone the inevitable reckoning with an opposite truth for as long as we can. God is our postponement. On this earth, within the limits of time, no nation is indispensable. No nation is forever. When it comes to the human condition, no nation is exceptional. And if one nation is under God, it is only because every nation is. Therefore, the joy with which we celebrate our nation's beginning must inform equally a sense that our nation's eventual end marks us as part of the human family, which remains America's true glory.
James Carroll, reading from his column Intimations of America's Mortality. Carroll's op-ed column appears regularly in the Boston Globe. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Virginia Prescott, Chris Bonacci, and Samantha Sadixon. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Have a good holiday. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.